This is the One Life Podcast. Our goal with this show is to enable and empower you to discover who you are so that you can take full advantage of the one life you have to live. I'm your host, Devin Rodriguez, and I thank you for joining us in this episode, and I hope you're ready for yet another discussion on how you can become the best version of yourself and live an impactful and fulfilled life. Today's guest is the one and only Chester Elton, who, for those of you that don't know, is one of the leading leadership experts in the world. Currently, he's ranked as the number four leadership expert in the world, but being able to talk with him and discuss with him things about leadership, the number is insignificant because the person that Lester is triumphs any number or rank that can be given to him. Not only is he a leadership expert, but he's also an executive coach. He also goes into companies and helps rework and reconfigure the company from the inside so that they can get more out of the company. I think it's funny, Chester, when a lot of companies think of consulting and so forth, at least from a college kid's perspective, we often think of technological revamps and going in and fixing it from the outside and then worrying about the inside. But what Chester does, he worries about the inside, and then he's noticed that outside results have come once the inside is actually fixed. On top of that, he's also a New York Times bestseller. And Chester, why don't you show us your new book, your latest book, Leading with Gratitude, which is a terrific book, which talks a lot about his great leadership philosophy. And he's a worldwide speaker, keynote speaker. And Chester, I really thank you. And you have Culture Works with your partner, in which you guys go in and you help, like I said, reconfigure these companies from the inside, which I think is great. And I really appreciate you being here with us, Chester, and giving us the opportunity to learn a little bit about leadership from one of the top leadership experts in the world. So thank you so much for being here.
Not a problem. A privilege to be on the One Life Podcast.
Well, thanks a lot, Chester. So how I always like to start it off is, clearly you've had a lot of success in your professional life, but where did this all come from? So if you could just walk us a little through who Chester was as a young person, a young kid growing up, and then, you know, what steps you took and how you wound up being one of the top leadership experts in the world.
Well, that's the movie on my life is coming out. You should probably just watch that. I think Tom Hanks is going to play me, actually. All kidding aside, I grew up in Canada. I was born in Edmonton, grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia, beautiful cities both, and in a ridiculously happy household. My father, probably, and my four older brothers, the biggest impact on me when it comes to leadership. My dad was in radio. He went from being an on-air personality to managing radio stations, and just had a wonderful philosophy on leadership in life. And to boil it down, it was that everybody really mattered. You know, the one thing I loved about my dad was he treated like the guy that was bagging his groceries and captains of industry the same. You know, his voice was the same. And he had a philosophy to say, just, you know, be good to everybody. Everybody's having a tough day, which I loved. And so I saw the way he managed and the culture that he created at the radio stations where he worked, and how people just loved to work for Dad. You know, they loved the industry, they loved radio, you know, more than anything, they loved the people they worked with and for, and that was my dad. So as I started to grow up in business and look to where I wanted to work and what I wanted to do, the journey was a bit meandering, right? I started in communications and media sales, which a lot of my brothers had done, and then I got an opportunity to work for a recognition company, actually. I grew up in sales, so my sales territory was northern New Jersey, where I still live today. And it was an employee recognition company that was all about, you know, recognizing years of service and sales and so on. And I loved that. You know, I came from a very competitive family. So, you know, the trophies and the plaques and everything was a part of growing up. And I loved that appreciation for people showing up and working hard every day. And so as I was selling these wonderful programs, I had an idea one day, and I had a great relationship with the then CEO, a guy named Kent Murdoch. I said, you know, Kent, my life would be a lot easier if we became the thought leaders in the industry. We were already one of the biggest, if not the biggest, suppliers of employee recognition, and yet we'd never published anything. And I said, you know, Kent, thought leadership comes with publishing. So if we could publish the definitive book on employee recognition and appreciation, people would call me instead of me having to call them. It was very self-serving, right? And he said, you know, I think that's a great idea. Go ahead and write the book. And I said, Ken, you know, you give me crushing sales quotas every year. I don't have time to write. Plus, I'm not a writer, right? And he said, you know what? You're a smart guy, figure it out. Isn't that a great comeback? You know, just do it. So for about a year, I played with ideas. And then Ken called me back and he said, I've always liked your idea of the book. I've hired a writer. His name is Adrian Gostick. You've got connections and ideas. Adrian can write. Introduce yourselves and write the book. Well, Adrian, born in England, grew up in Canada as well. So we had that hockey thing, you know, as all Canadians do. And a year after that, we dropped a book on Kent's desk. It was Managing with Carrots. And it was case studies of our best clients. And that's where it all started. We started to write together. We've been writing together now for 20 years. The Leading with Gratitude is our 12th book. We've sold over 1.5 million copies. They're in 30 languages. And that's where we went from, you know, recognition and deeper culture into leadership, teamwork, and our latest book on gratitude. So hopefully that all made sense.
Oh, absolutely, Chester. And just to give everybody that's listening to this or watching this a perspective of, you know, the people that are in your space and the people that you were ranked among, I mean, John Maxwell, Simon Sinek, people that I, as I shared with you another time, people that I have really always listened to and read and so forth, even in like the military, for example, Simon Sinek is one that is constantly promoted, and his leadership philosophy is adapted by a lot of people. And I would love if your work and what you publish would become more more aware and more not only appreciated but implemented in leaders' lives in the military as well, but also in regular sectors, like you were saying. So then talk to me a little bit about the carrot principles a little, Chester, because I, for example, when Tim Kinnegan put this together, as I told you, he talked to me a little bit about the one person, the one leader who he had 10 pennies in one pocket, and by the end of the day, he had to move all 10 to the other pocket. And those were all basically signs of gratitude that he showed to different employees. And that, to me, was a powerful way that a person can exude appreciation to others. So if you could talk to us a little bit about, maybe before the carrot principles, the power of appreciation and what effect that can have on an organization.
Sure. You know, the carrot principle, Adrian and I wrote years and years ago, and it was really more about the formal kind of recognition programs that companies have, you know, the pin, the plaque, the watch, and so on, which I think are very important. As our work progressed, we got more into culture. And the story about Carlos Aguilera that you cite with the 10 pennies was actually in our book, All In, which was all about creating a really engaging culture. And you know, I think that good leaders have a lot going on, right? A lot of things and habits they develop, healthy habits. They're very intentional about what they do, and they're very disciplined around what they do. And the thing we love about the Carlos Aguilera story is he was very intentional in that he wanted to appreciate all the little things that were going right every day and not just be the leader that pointed out when something went wrong. And so his intention was to do that. Well, the discipline was he'd put 10 pennies in his left pocket and he'd set a goal to have 10 positive interactions every day. And the way he would keep track is move it from his left pocket to his right pocket. So that's where the discipline came in. And as we were interviewing him for our book at lunch, he said, look, I've still got 8 pennies in my left pocket. Give me a couple of minutes. I've got to go out and engage with my people. Now, he couldn't always be physically with them, right? Sometimes it was a text, a handwritten note. Maybe it was a group chat on Slack or whatever it was. I just love the intention and I love the discipline that he set up this trigger to remind him every day. Now, we do a lot of executive coaching as well. And this is something we've challenged leaders to do and say, look, initially it's going to come across as I'm just doing it so I can tell you I did it. You know, is that really what you want? And I say, well, absolutely. You know, we need to start somewhere. It'll start to be something that you just do. The more that you do it, there'll be that tipping point where it becomes who you are. And so I think that's why the story of 10 pennies resonates with so many people, because it gives you something very actionable, something that you can track. And then over time, it becomes more who you are. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. It makes sense. So on that note, have you come across any other instances where people use some type of trigger or reminder that have said that enabled them to keep track of, you know, showing that appreciation or having those positive interactions? Because I think that those are extremely applicable to all of us that are listening to this or watching this.
Yeah. You know, in our book, Leading with Gratitude, we set up different tools and triggers. The one that I love about keeping a focus on gratitude is a gratitude journal. You know, that at the end of the day, that you write down 3 to 5 things that you're grateful for. My wife and I have a wonderful tradition. At the end of the day, we say, what are your three? What are 3 things you're grateful for? And then in the morning, I have this discipline. There are 8 things that I try to get to do, I try to get done every day. You know, write in a journal, read my scriptures, say my prayers, and so on and so on. And one of them is write down first thing in the morning, 3 to 5 things that I'm grateful for. So to start the day and end the day with a reflection on gratitude and that discipline is another wonderful best practice. A third one that I'm a big fan of, and it's really old school, is handwritten thank you notes. You know, to write a note 3 times a week, whether it's someone in your department or on your team or maybe in another department, and someone in your personal life. You know, it's like I say, it's old school and not many people do it anymore. And I think because of that, it's more impactful, right? That you get this handwritten, you know, mail right now, you got to admit, is pretty boring. You know, you might get some catalogs or you've got credit card offers or you've still got some paper bills that come in. It's really not very exciting. And yet when you get that handwritten note, what I love about it is it's personal, it's an uninterrupted conversation, and it's always timely because I've set aside the time to read that note. So whether it's 10 pennies, a gratitude journal, or handwritten notes, those are 3 that I think are great disciplines. You can be very intentional about it, that have huge payback for relatively little effort when you think about it.
Right. Now, Chester, one thing that when I was talking to Tim, I keep going back to him because he connected me with you. And one of the reasons he connected me with you, because we were talking a lot about the power of gratitude on our personal lives. And I was explaining to him that for me personally, I went through an experience, which I share on this podcast a lot, but losing my grandmother very suddenly. But what that did was that it enabled me to develop a sense of gratitude for especially time, but life in general. So what impact does practicing gratitude have for you in your personal life? And then how does that correlate to your professional life?
Well, you know, I don't think you have a personal life and a professional life anymore. You know, it used to be, you know, you'd work 9 to 5 and you had your work life, and then because no one could get a hold of you. I remember those days, by the way. It's pretty great, you know. Now with your smartphone, you know, I mean, you're available 24/7. And I think that is blended. You know, it used to be old school, was very much, you left your personal life at the door. Well, now you can't do that. I think particularly with COVID-19 is that the separation between your personal life and your work life is literally a door. Like you open the door, you're home, right? And so this idea of gratitude in my work life and gratitude in my personal life, it doesn't really resonate anymore. You have one life and you bring your best life with any kind of luck, right, to work, and you bring your best life home. One of the reasons Adrian and I are so passionate about our work, particularly around culture, is that very reason. You know, we have a database of over 1 million engagement surveys and another 80,000 motivators assessments that we've applied personally. And the idea that you spend so much time at work that when you're happy at work, you're 150% more likely to be happy in your personal life. That's why workplace culture is so important, because of the ripple effect into your personal life and into your communities. So these triggers, yeah, do they work really well at work? Absolutely. Do they work in your personal life? Yeah, that's why we say it's really one life.
So Chester, what is, when you go into an organization to try to work on it from the leadership standpoint or the culture standpoint, which we're going to get to, what are some of the most common mistakes that you see among leaders that they're making, that they're not getting the most out of their people because of X, Y, or Z reason? What are those reasons that you find are most common?
Well, you know, it's so great that you bring that up, because at the beginning of the book, we talk about the gratitude myths. and we debunk them one at a time. You know, one is a lot of leaders say, look, it's all about the Benjamins. Just get the compensation right, you know. Or the excuse I love is, I just don't have time. You know, we're doing hard things, particularly, you know, we're in all this civil unrest and the virus. You know, gratitude is a soft skill and a nice to have. And our research shows that it is clearly a hard skill and a must have to keep your people engaged and valued. So, you know, another one is fear is the best motivator. With your military background, I mean, fear can be a good motivator, right? Very short term. And yet, it doesn't necessarily, you don't want to build a culture of fear, right? And so we debunk those. My dad had a great expression. He'd say, you know, excuses, because that's what they are, right? Myths are excuses. Excuses, even when valid, are never impressive. So if you want to be world class, right, you don't make excuses. And as you look at the research, and you know, we studied Alan Mulally, who saved the Ford Motor Company. We studied WD-40, their tribal culture, with a 99% engagement score with their, you know, wonderful CEO, Gary Ridge, and Ken Chenault, you know, one of the few African-American CEOs at American Express. And they all took their organizations to record highs. You know, it's not a nice to have. It's not a soft skill. It is a hard skill. And it's an absolute must have, particularly in a crisis. So hopefully, you know, through our writing and through what we're doing and wonderful podcasts like yours, we'll change people's mindsets, because the research is rock solid. The case studies are phenomenal, and the tools are very simple. They're not simple to implement. You know, we say it's common sense, uncommonly practiced. And yet all the data, all the case studies, all the tools are there if you'll just pay attention and pick them up, right?
So Chester, to build off of that question. So for me, for example, I'm going to be a new leader walking into an organization which has already been formed, has already been together. You know, they probably had another leader before me, or they definitely did. And a lot of the people that are going to be watching this are going to be walking in or are in similar circumstances. So particularly when it pertains to a new leader walking into an organization that they haven't been a part of before, how do I start to build that culture where everyone is engaged, everyone is bought into what we are about, everyone buys into our ideas, even if it's not their idea, they still support the team's idea? How do I start, or how does one start to build that culture? Because I think that is like one of the top questions that you must get. How do I build that culture? But for a new leader going in, what is the process like?
You know, it's really interesting. I would refer to you to a great leader that we studied, Bill Manning. He's the president now of Toronto FC. And he talks about a third, a third, a third. You know, you come into a new organization, a third of the organization is going to buy in just because, right? A third of the organization, you're going to need to win over. And the last third, you're going to have to, will never buy in, right? And so you've got to figure that part out. What I love about what Bill does is he says, look, you appreciate the people that buy in right away, right? And then those that need convincing, it's through your actions, you know, and your core values. Now, the last third is really interesting. And sometimes, and actually, I'm sorry, it's the 20-60-20 rule. 20% buy-in, 60% you got to convince, 20% may never buy in. So I think as a leader, you know, to be really genuine and upfront is to really state what your vision for the team is. Appreciate the people that have bought in right away. In winning those people over is this transparency where you really want to say, hey, look, we're a team. We're in this together. And so let's figure this out. Where do we want to go as a group? And how can we get there? And how can I help, you know, the servant leaders? And then the toughest part is those that may never buy in, is you need to identify them pretty quickly and have those candid conversations with them that says, look, this is where we're going. This is how we're going to do it. Now, you don't have to buy in. Alan Mulally at Ford did this brilliantly. He said, look, this is our system. This is how we're going to do it. Now, you don't have to buy in, and that's okay. You just can't be a part of this team. You just can't live here, right? And I love that. It's just honest. It's open. Say, we want you to buy in. We want you to do well here. If you can't, that's okay. you just can't live here anymore, right? So the good leaders, and you will be a great leader, have those tough conversations. And again, you really appreciate the people that buy in right away. You really respect the people whose trust you earn. And then those outliers, and I'll tell you, the reason you got to get the guys that never buy in, how you got to identify pretty quick, is because initially your team, your organization, your group, whatever it is, will blame the disgruntled employees, the disgruntled team members. The longer they stay, that blame transfers to you because you're the leader and you could have fixed it and you chose not to. So often people say, well, manage around them or make accommodations or whatever. No, don't do that. Have the tough conversations. Get the team you want. Because as soon as you get the team you want, great things can happen. While you're still struggling, it's a battle every day, and nobody's happy. You're not happy, they're not happy, and the rest of the team's not happy. Hopefully that resonated.
Yeah, absolutely that resonates. And then I really like the point of having those tough conversations, because that's something that was taught to me throughout my experience in college. And not only that, but like that it's a pendulum, really. Like you were saying, there's going to be people that love you automatically just for who you are. Then there's going to be the people you have to work on. And then there's just going to be the people that just don't like you or what you're doing. And that is really hard to accept at certain times, because as a young leader, I've experienced myself wanting to be loved by everybody. And then when that population does not reciprocate that love, it's like, what am I doing wrong? Why do they not reciprocate my actions? And it's really frustrating.
Yeah, and I think more and more, you know, with the transparent culture that we live in, particularly with, you know, your generation coming up, where things are really transparent. I mean, you'll post literally anything, you know, on Facebook and so on. There are no mysteries. It's easier to have those conversations. And that's what I love about the transparency, where you can sit down and say, hey, look, this isn't working. This isn't working for me. This isn't working for you. One of the great leaders we've had the privilege to know over the years is Scott O'Neill. He's the CEO of HB Sports. You know, they own the Sixers and the Devils, and they own 30% of the Steelers and on and on. He said, you know, in our culture, we have a culture where we cheer for each other. And you know what? If it gets to the point where I can't cheer for you, or I get the sense that you're not cheering for me, we got to figure this out. And I love that metaphor, because when you look at your team, you know, as you take command of your next unit, right, it very quickly, you know, you'll be able to say, hey, I can cheer for these guys, right? These guys I may be unsure of, and these guys I can't cheer for. And you've got to ask yourself, why? Why can't I cheer for them? Or why do I get the sense they're not cheering for me? And that gives you permission to go in and have the conversation and get it fixed. Now, in speaking of permission, there's a really interesting concept in leadership. And that is the way a leader acts gives everyone else permission to act the same way. If you lead by fear, they will lead by fear, right? If your compass is a little off and you cheat a little bit on whether it's your expenses or, you know, your time clock or whatever it might be, everyone else says, well, if he's doing it, it's probably okay. I can do it too. So as leaders, I think that reflection at the end of the day on gratitude, it's also great to reflect on how did we do today? You know, what did we set out to do? What happened? What did I learn? How am I going to carry this forward? You know, because everybody's watching the leader 24/7. And the way you act gives everybody permission to act the same way.
So Chester, coming into a new, like I said, going into a new organization, once again, I've heard a couple different opinions on this, and it deals with the first like 30 to 90 days. Like, what should that look like? Should you go in changing things, or should I sit back on the sidelines and observe? You know, in your opinion, what should the first, you know, 30 days to 90 days look like as a new leader in a new organization?
I think that's very optimistic, 30 to 90 days. I think it's your first 10 minutes, if not the first 10 seconds, you know, the way you come in. And a lot of that, you know, look, great leaders do their homework. You know, look up your team, get to know what's going on. What is the history? What do they do well? What are areas that you think you can work on? You know, who are the personalities? who are the ringleaders, you know, who are the rabbis, who are the cheerleaders, and so that you can come in and just say, I love leaders that come in and say, hey, listen, it's an honor for me to lead. It really is. And I don't have all the answers. And, you know, by myself, I think I'm pretty smart. Together, we can be Einstein. So I want this to be really collaborative. I want you to be able to speak your minds. I want it to be safe to do that. Having said all that, there are times when the leader has to make a call. And I hope that, you know, when that time comes, everybody will buy in and move on. Having said that, here's what I understand as to what you've been doing and what you've done really well and your successes. And if I've left something out, let me know. And then I want to ask you, where would you like to be, you know, 6 months from now or a year from now or 2 years from now? What do we want our legacy as a unit to be? Do we want to be the hardworking guys? Do we want to be the guys that always go the extra mile? Do we want to be the groups that's known, that open to change, adaptable? Do we want to be those that look out for each other? You know, that we truly are brothers and sisters in this whole thing, and we're kind and we're grateful, and establish that early on as you come in, and then you got to live it, you know, and then you got to live it. You make those commitments and you live up to it. And I think, you know, first 30 to 90 days, no, it's, you know, it's your first, you know, 30 to 60 seconds.
That is a big difference from what I've heard. And I love it. Like you said, yeah. You know, addressing that immediately is important, obviously, in your eyes. And I think that's something that I'll definitely carry forward. But I was listening to a video on YouTube of you recently. And one of the things that you talked about was that the essence or the foundation of creating a culture, which is a positive one, is trust. That trust is really the foundation of it all. So can you talk a little bit about that and then how to build trust? Because I've talked to a lot of different leaders on their opinion on how to build trust. One example was doing hard things together, that shared hardship, creating that trust. And through personal experience, I've noticed that that is true. But in your opinion, why is trust so important, and how can I go in, or any, I'm just using myself as an example, how can anyone go in and start to build that trust with their team?
Yeah, I mean, trust is table stakes, right? If you don't trust your leader, or you don't trust the people that work with and for you, I mean, you have no foundation for anything. It creates a very unsafe environment. You know, Amy Edmondson wrote a wonderful book called The Fearless Organization, and it's all about psychological safety. So without trust, you have no psychological safety. Everything that comes out is, oh, what did they really mean by that? Where are we really going? What's the true? And I know what they said. What does it mean? Right? Now, in our research, and this was research we did for the Carrot Principle, it was, you know, 200,000 engagement surveys. The number one driver of trust is communication. I love your idea about let's go do hard things together, and we'll learn to trust each other as we do hard things. I think that's very experiential. I think before all that happens, it's communication. You know, are we honest and open in our communication? And do we communicate in a cadence that makes sense? You know, some people need a daily affirmation. Other people, it's weekly, monthly, semi-annually. You know, you get the hermits go, look, just check in with me at the beginning and the end of the year, and I'm fine, right? Tailor the communication to the individual. Make sure you've got a lot of different channels to communicate. You know, have you got a Slack channel? Have you got a newsletter? You know, do you pick up the phone? Do you Zoom? Whatever it might be, right? And the idea of communication, because when there's a lack of communication, when there's a void, that void gets filled. You know, a vacuum, you know, gets filled. And it gets filled with rumor, innuendo, and fear, right? None of those are positive. So even if you haven't got anything to add, like people say, well, COVID, you know, I think we're over-communicating. I said, look, if you think you're over-communicating, it's probably about right, right? Because in that gap, it gets filled with negativity. It's just the way we're wired. We're protecting ourselves, right? Very few of us get up in the morning and say, what's going to go right today? You know, we're all wondering what's going to go wrong, right? And that we hope for the best, but we prepare for the worst, right? So when you have that ongoing communication, you reduce anxiety and stress. Even if it's, hey, just a quick update, nothing has changed. I just want to know nothing has changed. So the premise that we're working on that today. Good? Good. Boom. no mystery, no gaps, no worries. We're on track. And that's to me, the number one driver of trust is always communication. Do I trust the communication? Do I trust the messenger? And this is why, quite frankly, I think in our political system, things are broken. No one trusts anything anybody says, you know, and we get our information from one channel. And whatever that one channel says that we've decided is the only true information, then you get into that algorithm and, you know, everything you get feeds that information and you don't have a broader view. So, you know, as leaders, I think it's really contingent upon making sure that we are trusted in what we say and that what we say is true. And when we say, when we make a mistake, are people trust us enough to say, you know what? I really thought this is what we should do and I was wrong. Let's fix it. Let's move on. That's safe. That's trusted. That's great communication. Make sense?
Oh, 100% makes sense. And to go off of what you were just saying, one of the things I've been told that a good leader will do is that accept responsibility for the shortfalls, but then give credit for the things that their subordinates or employees have done that have, you know, positively impacted the organization, as opposed to someone who just takes credit for everything and gives blame to everybody else. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. I think the telltale sign of a weak leader is when you hear them say, I take no responsibility for that. I take no responsibility for that. Well, how can you not take responsibility? It was your organization. It was your people. Now, you may not have done it. I get that. That there is no responsibility. And to your point, everything that good happens was because of me. Everything bad that happens is somebody else's fault. Come on. You know, who writes the book on that? You know, the Bible for leadership. Take credit for everything that's good and blame somebody else for everything else that goes wrong. Come on. Who's working for that person? You know, so I think there are, you know, triggers to do positive things. I think there are triggers that let you know, is a leader really genuine? Is a leader really worth your loyalty and worth your time? And if you're hearing phrases like, I take no responsibility for that, or and are very, very reticent to give anyone else credit, those are warning signals. Those are triggers that those are probably not people you should be investing your time, talent, and treasure with.
Yeah, I really like that, Chester, and thank you for sharing that point with us. And another thing that I was listening to on another one of your talks was the fact that people think that culture and appreciation and you being the apostle of appreciation.
Right? Amen, brother.
People think that it's soft stuff. But once you get the soft stuff right, the hard stuff becomes easy. Is what you were saying. If you could touch on that, I think that is really impactful because it seems as if you're saying that a lot of culture has it backwards. And if we can correct that, it can make not only our companies more successful, but ourselves more successful. And you mentioned in one of your talks and you showed how drastically revenue increased as the positivity in culture increased. And for me, once again, it stemmed from working from the inside and then the outside became much easier. So if you could talk about that, the soft, you know, getting the soft stuff right and the hard stuff becomes so much easier. I think that is so fascinating.
Yeah, the soft stuff is the hard stuff. And the reason the soft stuff is the hard stuff is because it's emotional. You know, when you're dealing with spreadsheets and numbers and so on, yeah, that's the hard stuff. That's actually fairly easy. When you have to engage people, you know, intellectually and emotionally, that's hard. I mean, listen, I got four kids. That's hard. It just is. And our kids are four different points on the compass. You know, you deal with each one differently. You don't, you know, old school is we deal with everybody the same because that's fair. Well, you know, that's not only not right, it's stupid. You know, different people are motivated by different things. The great leaders know their team. They know who to put client facing. They know who to put on research. They know how to put a team together with, you know, not just diversity and in race and gender and generationally, motivationally, they're diverse. You know, somebody that cares about the environment, somebody that cares about the customers, somebody who cares about, you know, the team and so on. So yeah, the soft stuff is the hard stuff because it's emotional and it's complicated. People are complicated, right? You know, it's a, there was an old cartoon, you know, Snoopy, the Charles Schulz, the old comic strip, and Snoopy the dog would say, you know, I love mankind. It's people I can't stand. Like, I love the concept of mankind, but when you get down to the individual people, that's, you know, I can't stand that. So the good leaders will invest some time into understanding their team. The great leaders invest a lot of time and have excellent soft skills. Now, if you go through your life, the people that you would do anything for are the people that not only you respected because of their talent, you respected them because of your relationship with them, right? They cared about you, so you cared about them. You wouldn't let them down, not because you thought they were the smartest person in the room, because they were the person in the room that cared about you, and you wouldn't let them down. Am I right?
You are 100% right on that, Chester. Okay, yeah, so to go a little more into that now, you are a big advocate for showing appreciation now, here in the moment, because as you often say, if you know the Super Bowl, when do they award the team the trophy, the Lombardi trophy? They do it there and then. They don't do it 2 weeks from then, a year from then. They do it there and then. They don't get to take a shower first. They do it while they're nice and sweaty as they just won. Now, I know you have four steps that you talk about showing appreciation now. And then there's three other ones, which I'll let you dive into a little bit. I don't want to take it from you, obviously. But if you could talk a little bit about those, because as I listened to it, it makes you develop a new perspective on how to lead. Because like you said, the number one thing that leaders say when it's time to show appreciation or give a token of appreciation is, I don't have time. But the moment that someone does something negative, we have all the time in the world to address that. So it's a little, you know, there's a little paradox and dichotomy there. So if you could talk to us a little bit about those four principles, I guess what you one can call them, I think that'll help leaders open a new perspective in their mind.
Sure. Do it now. Do it often. Be specific. Be sincere. And I would even add to that, don't be afraid. You know, do it now, because the closer the recognition is to the behavior, the more likely it is to be repeated. It's primacy, recency. It's a very simple premise. The longer you wait, the less impact it has. Do it often. You know, people say, well, can you overdo it? I mean, then it becomes trite if you do it too much. And I always say, look, I challenge you to find anybody at the end of the day that goes to their spouse or their family and says, man, I couldn't get anything done today. I mean, just so much praise and recognition, you know, with balloons and cakes and tickets to Hawaii. And, you know, it never happens. We look at engagement surveys, you know, around the world, and almost categorically, except for the exceptions like American Express and the WD-40 and Ford when Alan Mulally was there, I feel appreciated for my work is near the bottom. So I love leaders that say, well, I don't want to do it too much. It'll become trite. And I say, look, I've seen your 360 review. Trust me, you're not doing it too much. We talk about the gratitude gap. 70% of leaders think they are above average in giving recognition and appreciation. Only, 23% of their direct reports agree. So there's that gap. So do it now, do it often. Don't worry about doing it too much. You know, wouldn't that be great? You know, be specific. General praise has no impact. You just can't walk in and say, hey, great job, great job. You know, you're the best. You're the Tower of Pisa. You know, the specificity gives you credibility. I like what you did with that customer that came in. That was a problem with the warranty. You walked him through it. You went the extra mile. You got it satisfied. That'll be a customer who came in angry, left happy. They're a customer for life. See, so that's what customer service looks like, right? Yeah. And then the sincerity, I think specificity goes a long way in making it sincere. The other thing is people know, they know if you're checking the box, right? They know if you're just doing it so you can tell HR you did it, right? And if you've got a relationship like Carlos Aguilera with the 10 pennies, it's frequent enough, it's often enough. It's not what he does, it is who he is. That comes through. And then lastly, you know, just lately, I said, look, don't be afraid. You know, well, I'm not going to be very good at it. You go, well, of course you're not going to be very good at it. You don't ever do it. When was the last time you picked up golf clubs for the first time and, you know, golfed in 18? You had 18 hole-in-ones. I mean, it never happens, right? the more you do it, the better you'll get. So the trick is just start and know that you're not going to be good at it, and even apologize for it. That's fine. Say, look, this recognition thing's new to me. This gratitude thing is, you know, it's not, I want to get better at it. So if I screw up, forgive me. Come on. Who's not going to give that person a break? Right. So yeah, that's our rule of four. Do it now, do it often, be specific, be sincere.
Right. Okay. And those are really, really simple to remember, but also effective, like you're saying, in these organizations that you have worked with. So to go back to your point about kind of aligning that portion of appreciation with who you are and your identity, you know, I feel a large problem, especially with a lot of young people, is the fact that they don't know who they are or what their identity consists of. This is going maybe a little off of the topic of leadership and more towards personal development and self-growth. How does a young person begin that journey to discover who they are and those principles that they have to discover that they can then take into that leadership role?
Well, I think you just have to ask yourself, who do you want to be? You know, how do you want to be remembered? I think right now is a wonderful time for self-reflection. You know, as we go through all these crises, how do we want to be remembered? What will be your legacy? So if you're young, you say, well, I'm not really sure who I am. I say, well, how would you like to be remembered? You know, Stephen Covey had the great exercise. At your funeral, what do you want people to say? You know, do you want them to say, man, that kid could sell? Or do you want them to say, you know, he was a great dad. He was a great friend. He was a great neighbor. You could always count on him. You know, I would submit the latter is the better funeral, right? So as early on in your career, say, well, who do I want to be? Who are those people that I really admire? A good friend of mine, Aisha Bursell, has a wonderful program called Design the Life You Love. And what she asks is, you know, write down five people or six people that you really admire. Just write their names down. And why do you admire them? You know, and you'll often write down your mom or your dad, or, you know, maybe it's Winston Churchill or Jack Kennedy or whatever, right? And you know, why do you admire them? Well, because they did hard things, because they were kind, because they were always there for you, because they were a true friend. Well, that gives you a pretty good idea of the values that you value and who you would like to be. You know, strong, courageous, kind, thoughtful. So step back, and if you're not sure who you are, say, well, who would I like to be? And write it down and say, okay, if I want to be a good friend, what does that look like? If I want to be thoughtful and kind, what does that look like? And specifically draw out people that you love and admire, because they'll give you the roadmap. Remember we talked to you about, as a leader acts, it gives people permission to do the same. Well, the people that you admire, how do they act? How do they do it? And replicate that. It's a great formula.
Yeah, I think that's powerful. Like you were saying, though, about the portion of asking who you want to become. I'll give you a for instance. It was just a couple of months ago when I was still in school, you know, in person. And it was a computer science class. And the professor asked a question. She said, who knows what they want to do after college? And there was 30 seniors in the room. And I had ROTC lined up. So obviously, I was blessed enough to know what I wanted to do, but I was the only person that raised my hand when she asked that question, and it blew my mind away. Like, we don't know what we want to do. And then that's why ultimately I started the organization, the Society of Growth and Success, because I want to help other students discover who they are. Because I feel like once a student or a young person does that, then everything else just comes so much easier to you, because a lot of the noise is just canceled out, because you know what you have to focus on to get you where you want to be. But yeah, it's so lost in it. Go ahead, Chester.
Yeah, I would change that up. Just my perspective is, who knows what they want to do? Well, you know, when I was younger, I didn't say, you know, I want to write books. I want to be, you know, an expert in leadership and culture. I didn't know that was going to be the end result. I think the better question is, who do you want to be?
Yeah.
Now, I think the reason that you're in ROTC and so on is that is a great vehicle for you to become a great leader. You are a student of leadership. You want to lead. And so you're doing ROTC to get you to that goal. So, you know, I think it's the wrong question. how many know what you want to do? Well, you know, I knew I wanted to be in sales, I guess. I didn't know what kind of sales. And then from there, what I wanted to be was I wanted to be a trusted advisor. I wanted to be, you know, really good at what I did. I wanted to keep my values straight so that when opportunities presented themselves, you will have life after the Army.
Of course.
You know, it may be in 5 years, it may be in 35 years. And what you want to become is the right kind of person so that when opportunities present themselves, I never in my wildest dreams, you know, believed that I was going to become a co-author of New York Times bestselling books. What I did know is that in thought leadership and writing was a great way to influence organizations. And because, you know, Adrian had the skill, that I had some of the relationships and we had good core values, we were able to do that. So I think that's an interesting question. What do you want to do? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what I want to do tomorrow. I know who I am.
Right. And that's the whole point that I try to just share with people. Cause I feel like in the society of, especially like social media and all of these things that surround us that are constantly telling us, what do you want? Such as, you know, all of these celebrities sharing their fancy houses, clothes, cars, et cetera. It's all about having these tangible goods. But before you have the tangible goods, you have to discover the answer to the intangible questions. Like you were saying, who do I want to become? And like you going back to Covey's book or one of his practices, beginning with the end in mind, like you were saying, that's something that I've really been able to implement in my life. So when it comes to like, at one of the workshops that we actually did with the organization, it had to do with imagining your own funeral. And people at first were like, what are you saying? What are you talking about? But breaking it down and not looking at it morbidly, but in terms of it can help you design your next 10, 20 steps, it becomes so much easier, and it makes you such a more happy person and makes you practice more gratitude, going back to what you were saying.
Well, yeah, it's a legacy play. And, you know, I know we've just got a couple of minutes left here. You know, there are resources. We've got a wonderful website, leadingwithgratitudebook.com. You can download the first chapter and the foreword. There's podcasts. There's all kinds of fun stuff there. Our training company is thecultureworks.com, because when your culture works, everything else gets better. And, you know, Adrian and I both encourage people to follow us on LinkedIn. We've got a LinkedIn live show. We've got a Leading with Gratitude or the Gratitude Journal newsletter that comes out once a month. There are a lot of resources and interviews and stuff there as you try to find your way. You know, just in closing, I'd love to leave this thought with you that, you know, as we go through all this stuff, and there's all kinds of stuff, right? There's elections, there's civil unrest, there's, you know, COVID-19. I hope that as we go through all of these crises, whether it's personal or educational or in business, that we really do step back and say, look, we're going to be a little more grateful. We're going to be a little more kind, and we're going to be a little more patient with each other. You know, I think that if those three things come out of this crisis, that we'll be better organizations, we'll be better communities, and we'll be better people. You know, I love to say, look, leading with gratitude is a great way to lead an organization. We have the data to prove it. It's also just a better way to live. You know, to be grateful for what you have and not pining for what you don't have. Be grateful, be kind, be patient. I think it's a great formula for a great life. And I really just appreciate our time together. Thank you for the questions and good luck with your journey in leadership.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Chester. And I pray that those three things come out of this whole crisis, I should say, because there's multiple that we're dealing with. Yeah. I really pray that it happens as well. And I really appreciate you taking the last 45 or so minutes out of your day to spend it here. And I know a lot of young leaders or leaders in general are really going to benefit. So I really thank you so much, Chester. And I really look forward to talking to you again soon.
You bet. Take care, my friend.
Thanks, Chester.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you guys so much for listening to yet another episode of the One Life Podcast. I hope that you were able to take one or two of these ideas that we discussed today and are able to implement them in your life to make you more successful in whatever it is that you're chasing. Remember, only one life to live, no time to wait, act now. See you guys on the next episode of the One Life Podcast.